Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for all of you today. My guest will be Lauren O'Neilius. She is the founder of Food Empowerment Project, and she's also the executive director. And it is an animal rights organization, and it's doing some really great work, and I'm going to let her tell us about it in just a little bit. First, I want to go over some of the things going on in and around the news, some ways that you can all get involved, and also some things that are going on around the city. And, of course, I want to share this week's recipe with you. So first, right after today's show, I'm going to be skedaddling to Senator Schumer's office in Melville, Long Island. But there will be these rallies going on all across the state today to let Senator Schumer know that we want him to really stand strong against some of the anti-environment, anti-immigration, anti-everything policies that our new administration and president is doing. It's just really, really a very serious situation. There's not that much we can do about it except stand up and show up. And so there's a big rally today that's being organized by the Sierra Club and Food and Water Watch and many other wonderful organizations. And as I said, these rallies will be going on in all eight of Schumer's offices throughout New York State. And it's just to, you know, really let him know that we are here and that we want him to take charge as the leading Democrat to stand up against Trump's agenda. And so I hope some of you are planning on attending as well. You know, I list it in my newsletter along with so many ways that you can take action and get involved. This evening, there is a organizational meeting in New York City at an auditorium on 310 West 43rd Street. This organizational meeting is for the People's Climate March. If you remember, a few years back, we had a huge turnout at the People's Climate March in New York City. Well, this one is going to be in Washington, D.C., as well as cities across the country. There will be a sister march in New York City as well for the environment. And it's just, again, people coming together and showing up. And I think we're just seeing the beginning of this. There were protests this week at JFK Airport and airports across the country with his immigration ban. You know, the spin that the Trump administration is trying to do is like, you know, Trump is a man of action. He's taking action, but he's not really, he is not really upholding the Constitution and what our country stands for. We are inclusive. We are diverse. And that is the way it has been since our founding fathers founded this country. And although that's not so true either, as we know, Native American Indians, there's been a spin on that. But nevertheless, we are a land that has always welcomed immigrants from other countries, and we need to keep doing so. We are a melting pot here in America, and we need to make the love stronger, not the hate stronger. And he is just undoing all these wonderful things that we've been doing. So anyway, if you feel moved to come to this organizational meeting to make the People's Climate March happen and to be a big success, it will take a lot of organizing. And so this is this evening from 6:30 to 8:30 at 310 West 43rd Street. So I hope some of you can make it there. Also, starting today, Food Tank is having their summit, which is today and tomorrow. In years past, I've always gone to the Food Tank Summit. It's a wonderful, wonderful event. But since I was in D.C. last weekend for the march, I thought I'd take this one off. But Food Tank is a wonderful organization, also worth knowing about and getting on their email list that you can get their newsletters, because they send out such great information. Really, really wonderful. February 9th, Slow Food East End is having their pasta making class. That should be fun. February 11th is the second annual City Growers Educational Conference in Brooklyn. And that should also be a great conference, bringing together educators, farmers, community gardeners, public employees, and funders, all coming together to try to, expand gardens in the city. So that should be really great. The New York Oyster and Beer Festival is happening on February 11th. That's from 12 to 6 at the Tunnel. All of these things, by the way, you can find out about on my website at iegreen.com. This past weekend, I got to share with you, we had a great slow food event at the new Oyster Bay Brewery. Their beer was great, and the food, which was all made by I Eat Green and volunteers from Slow Food, put out a huge spread, and it was just wonderful. We had about 60 people show up. We stopped selling tickets at 50, but we had people show up at the door, and we let them in, and it was just bustling, and everybody was mingling. You had to mingle because there weren't enough seats for everybody, but it was just really a fun event, and Slow Food is an organization that is just so close to my heart. And with, again, the Trump agenda taking hold, we need to really find the organizations that we can sink our teeth into and that we can feel in alignment with and come together with people of like mind and work towards a sustainable future. And we really can't do that if we don't have sustainable country. So as much as I care about sustainable food, and you all know I do, we first have to work on a sustainable country. So, I usually don't like to get too much into politics, but it's hard not to in this day and age. And so I've talked about the Indivisible Guide for the past few weeks, and that's a great guide online of ways you can take action. So look that up. It's called the Indivisible Guide. And it has, step-by-step instructions of ways that you can organize locally. And we all need to do that. And it's modeled actually after the Tea Party, believe it or not. They saw this Indivisible Guide was written by people who have worked for the government and saw how the Tea Party came into power and how they went from a little nothing to really being a loud voice in politics. And they did it by starting small and starting local. And using that model, the Indivisible Guide is really going to teach us all how to become active citizens. So check that out. Back to going-ons in and around the city. February 19th, Hawthorne Valley Biodynamic Farm is having their winter intensive, and that's an incredible opportunity to go there and live there and really learn about organic gardening. And biodynamics is a form of organic gardening that was established through Rudolf Steiner, also the founder of the Waldorf School movement. And it's just a spiritual approach to organic gardening. Really wonderful, and the vegetables are just incredible that are grown that way. Just Food is having their annual conference at the Teachers College, Columbia University, March 12th and 13th. That's always a wonderful organization, and Just Food, or a wonderful conference. Just Food is a great organization that promotes school gardens and educational opportunities throughout the city. They're just a great organization. So if you don't know about them, check them out. And this is a wonderful conference that brings so many people together to learn new skills, to attend talks, to have hands-on opportunities. So it's really great. So if you can make that, it's worth it, March 12th and 13th. Up at Stone Barns, they're having their sheep shearing festival, which always sells out. That's April 29th. I've never made it there. I'm never in time to buy the tickets, but I've never seen a sheep sheared, so I was certainly interested in that. But if you're interested, tickets are already going on sale, and they do sell out, so check that out. March 31st, TEDx is happening at Adelphi University. This is their second year doing these TEDx talks at Adelphi, and they sell out as well. So you know, the prices are really great. They have student prices for $15, regular price for $20, and their talks are really wonderful, so that's worth it. Save the date for April 29th for the People's Climate March, which will be in Washington, D.C. and everywhere else, and I hope to see you there. I want to share with all of you this week's recipe. As I've shared with many of you, I have really given up dairy and have been eating vegan now since May, and I'm really feeling great and feeling good about it. But I still have my little cravings for cheese, and so I've been venturing out and gathering recipes and playing with different ways of making mock cheese. And I shared with you a few weeks ago a cashew chèvre cheese that I make. And now this is a tofu feta cheese, and it's really delicious. And, you know, I don't know that I would just eat it plain, although I did. It's delicious. But in a salad, I'm telling you, it's just like having a Greek salad, and it's really wonderful. So this recipe calls for 1 cup of miso, and I used half mellow white miso and half red miso, mostly because that's the kind that I always have in my fridge, and I always like mixing them. But if you just have one or the other, that's fine. I used 1/2 cup of organic dry white wine and 1/4 cup of organic mirin. Now, when you get mirin, I just have to tell you, Kikkoman, the same company that makes a soy sauce, they make a product that they call mirin, but it is not mirin. If you look at the ingredients, it's actually corn syrup. And it blows me away that a store like Whole Foods will even carry it. And it's not even GMO-free or GMO-certified. So don't buy Kikkoman mirin. You really want to buy a real mirin, which is made from sweet rice. And I use Eden brand, and I can verify that that's a really excellent brand. It's expensive, but it's worth it. You get what you pay for. So, you know, just use it sparingly. But this calls for 1/4 cup. I use 1 pound of extra firm sprouted tofu, 1/2 lemon, 1 tablespoon of olive oil, and 1 teaspoon salt. And so you're going to start by making a marinade with the miso, the wine, and the mirin. And just mix that together in a bowl. You're going to slice the tofu into slices that are about 1/2 inch thick and lay them out on a dish towel and put another dish towel on top and just press down lightly. You're trying to absorb as much of the water out of the tofu. Then take the tofu and lay them out into a Pyrex dish, a glass Pyrex dish, a large enough dish that you can lay the tofu out in a single layer, and then cover it with the marinade. And then turn the pieces over so that the marinade is covering both the bottom and the top of the Pyrex. And actually, if you wanted, you could put 1/2 the marinade in the bottom of the Pyrex pan, put the other 1/2 of the marinade on top, and that might even be easier. And just spread it around. And then you're going to let that sit covered in the refrigerator for a full week. Yep, a full week. And just, you know, mark the top of the casserole so you know when a week is up. And then after a week, you're going to remove it from the refrigerator, rinse off the marinade, and I just did it under running water. If you want, you could fill a bowl with some cold water and just gently wipe the marinade off, and then dry the tofu again on a dish towel with another dish towel on top to dry off the water. Then I made a little slurry of the 1 tablespoon of olive oil, the 1/2 lemon, and the salt. And I just brushed that over each of the pieces of tofu, and I let that sit for 24 hours in the fridge before using it. And I'm telling you, it is such a close double of feta cheese. It's really great. So enjoy it. I didn't make enough my first time, but I'm going to make a big batch the next time because I really want to try making spinach pie. That's another one of my favorite dishes where I use feta cheese in the past. And I'm going to make a bunch of this tofu feta and make a spinach pie, and I will let you all know how it is. And, of course, if it meets my expectations, I'll share that recipe with you as well. But now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest this week, Lauren Ornelius. She is the founder of the Food Empowerment Project. She's also the group's executive director, and she's been an animal rights activist for more than 30 years. She was the former executive director of Viva USA, which was a national nonprofit vegan advocacy organization that came out of the UK, modeled after Viva UK. And Viva UK had actually asked her to start a USA chapter in 1999, and she did that for many years. And that organization investigated factory farms, and they ran consumer campaigns to really to kind of shed light on what is really going on in factory farms. And she actually got Trader Joe's to stop selling duck meat through her work. And I'm going to let her come on and tell us more about it. Lauren, are you with me?
I am. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Before we go on to all the questions I have for you, can you just give a little background to the Food Empowerment Project and tell us what that is and what inspired you to start it?
Sure. Food Empowerment Project is a vegan food justice organization. So we encourage people to not eat animals if they have access to healthy food as a way to lessen some of the suffering of the world. So we really look at animals as sentient beings and do our part not to contribute to their suffering, whether it be for food or entertainment or any other ways that animals are exploited in our society right now. We also, in promoting veganism, we also recognize that we rely on farm workers for our food and that we're encouraging people to eat more fruits and vegetables. So we actually work on farm worker issues. We support corporate campaigns called by farm worker organizations. We work on legislation and regulatory changes. And we also do a school supply drive every year for the children of farm workers. We also work on trying to get people not to buy chocolate from the worst forms of child labor, including slavery. So we have a list of chocolates we do and don't recommend, which people can also get in the form of an app, which we update every month to help people who don't want to support what's happening in places like Western Africa and buy chocolate that's more ethical.
Yeah, my certified chapter, we have a film screening that we do every year and a food fest, and we showed the film, The Dark Side of Chocolate. Have you seen that
one? I have. Actually, my mentor, who passed away a couple years ago, was the filmmaker on that. And the follow-up to that was called Shady Chocolate.
Oh, I don't know that one.
Yeah, Shady Chocolate exposes a lot of the various certifications, and that was done, I believe, in 2013.
Uh-huh. Good. Well, yeah. I'll try to get that one next time.
Because
it
was
a fascinating, eye-opening expose to chocolate. You know,
yep.
Things you don't think about.
Exactly. That most people have no idea.
Now, when you say you support farm workers, is your organization doing anything to mobilize against the wall being planned by our new wonderful president?
Right. What we're doing right now is many of the farm workers that we work with in terms of the school supply drive, they are all undocumented. So as of right now, we're doing as we always do. We'll be collecting school supplies later this year, and we'll be delivering to them in August. So what we're doing in terms of just actively opposing the wall, we're doing what most people are doing in protesting, but also trying to figure out how to help with the sanctuary cities. We're based in California, so we are, I should say, a little bit lucky that it seems the state of California at this point seems like they're going to try and do what they can to prevent some of these deportations and things such as that. So we're going to be supporting legislation in California to make sure that the people in this state are protected. I have to be honest that at this point, I don't know what to do about the federal aspect of things. We have one fantastic California senator federally, but, you know, Dianne Feinstein, who's the other legislator, she actually supported the wall a number of years ago. So, you know, we're really looking at what we can do on a more local level.
Right. Right. That's what I was talking about with the Indivisible Guide at the beginning of the show.
Exactly.
That we really need to use the model that the Tea Party, you know, they grew so quickly, and it really was starting small and starting local.
We have made more influence with our local legislators, and we got to be using that influence.
Right, right. That's why after this show, I'm going to be skedaddling to Senator Schumer's office and join the rally there. Because
so great.
It's imperative that everyone who feels that their rights and their freedoms are being challenged with this new administration has to stand up. And that,
yep,
to me is the only silver lining that I could possibly think of with,
right,
this new administration, is that it might get the complacency that so many people have had and get them out of their chairs and up onto their feet and out protesting.
Yep, definitely.
That's the only thing I can hope for.
Anyway,
back to your work, the Food Empowerment Project. You know, I was looking over your website. You use the term lactose normal instead of lactose intolerant. Can you explain that a little bit to me and my listeners?
Absolutely. The reason we do this is because a lot of people of color, I'm a Chicana, so I'm of Mexican descent. A lot of us cannot digest the milk of another species into adulthood. And this term has been used, lactose intolerant, which makes it seem like there's something wrong with us that we can't digest this.
Right,
and
right.
And so we felt like too many times the onus is put on people of color that we can't do this, when in fact we're actually normal. It's actually okay not to digest the cow's milk as an adult. You also look into things like colonization and how colonization really impacted our diets. You know, we didn't have, you know, cows. That was brought over by Columbus and colonization. So that's not really natural for us, hence our inability to digest cow's milk or goat's milk, you know, as an adult.
Right, right. So that makes sense. Yeah, so often that, you know, the onus is put on the victim instead of
right.
on, you know, the other side. So that makes sense. To call it
normal. Cow's milk made for a calf, you know, not for a human being. It's they actually, they have this reproductive cycle of, you know, a cow is 9 months, and when, you know, they produce milk, that milk is supposed to go to their babies and not to human beings.
Uh-huh. What inspired you to get, to become a vegan activist or an animal activist?
I actually, when I was really young and I went vegetarian, my mom told me what chicken was. I didn't realize that what I was eating was a chicken. And so I stopped eating animals. But as our financial situation wasn't great, I ended up having to go back to eating animals. And it wasn't until I was in high school that, and I grew up in Texas in the 80s. So going vegan and vegetarian back then wasn't the easiest, but I didn't want to contribute to the suffering of other beings. And I think for me, you know, when I think about it as an adult, I realized that, you know, my family was going through a divorce. My mom was, you know, having to drop me off at daycare when I was really little. And the pain of being separated from my mom was really intense. And I think that the idea of separating families and being responsible for, you know, a baby cow and not seeing her mom again was just too much for me, that I didn't want to contribute to it. And I would see cows all the time in Texas, and I would just think how sad it would be if they weren't together anymore. And so I think that kind of started my idea of, you know, wanting to, you know, go, you know, start working on issues impacting non-human animals. I went vegan when I was in high school in the late 80s in Texas, and, you know, got into animal rights and just realized that, you know, I was actually in the position to where I could make changes in my life to stop participating in a form of suffering. The apartheid was going on in South Africa, and so many horrible things were going on in the world, and I just felt like that was one way I could have some control to lessen some of the suffering in the world, was to not consume or harm animals.
Mm-hmm. So now you've been vegan for how long?
Actually, this is my 29th year being vegan.
Cool. Very cool.
Thank you.
So you want to share a little bit with some of my listeners about the production of egg and dairy? Because I know lots of times people are like, well, you know, it's okay to eat eggs, you're not hurting the chickens, or it's okay to eat dairy, you're not hurting the cows. You want to shed a little light on why, as an animal activist, do you think that is so bad?
Sure. You know, I've investigated factory farms and slaughterhouses. And, you know, again, I too, when I first went vegetarian, it was like, you know, I just didn't want to cause harm to the animals. And a lot of people have this idea that, you know, the cow doesn't have to be killed to give milk and the chickens don't have to be killed for their eggs. But
exactly,
the
right.
system, you know, the system is such that it is that that's just not true. You have cows who, mother cows, who again have their babies, and their babies are taken away from them, if not a day, immediately after birth. And the mothers cry. I've videotaped cows and their babies bellowing back and forth to each other. I've been at auction houses where baby calves, their umbilical cords are still wet. And this is done because the, you know, just like a human, just like a mammal would, they're only producing milk when they're pregnant. So they keep these cows constantly impregnated, and so they have this excess of babies. And so the males are of no use to them, so they get rid of the males because they can't produce milk, and that's what sometimes has become veal in some states. Those are baby male cows who are kept in crates so small they can't even turn around. If the mama has a female, then her baby is then turned back to the herd, and she's kept in crates so small she can't turn around. And you can see hundreds and hundreds of these crates in California where the little female calves are kept, and all they have is water and some food. And eventually when they're of age, they'll become impregnated and they'll join the herd too. And cows can live to be, you know, 25 or so years old, but in the dairy industry, because they're constantly impregnated and milked, they're killed at about 5 or 6 years old, and that's what people tend to eat as hamburgers. If people have seen downed cows where cows are being picked up by, you know, machinery because they can't walk, they're dragged, those are the mother cows whose bodies are so broken down from producing milk and having to give birth that they just can't walk anymore. And, you know, for the egg industry, you know, even, you know, and I should say this for both of these, you know, it doesn't matter how big or small these farms are. These are inherent in this industry. A cow, a small dairy will still have the cows separated from their moms because they need, they feel, you know, that that is the milk that they're going to sell to human beings. And so they don't want to give that milk to the babies. And the same thing with the egg industry. It doesn't matter if these are small, you know, backyard hens. The chickens themselves are coming from an industry where the baby male chicks are of no use to that industry, and so the baby male chicks are killed. And you have, you know, the chickens, the hens who are laying eggs either in cages stacked high or in sheds crammed in, and many of them have the tips of their beaks cut off because of the close confinement, and they'll just end up pecking each other. So, again, these animals are, you know, really commodified. If you've ever picked up a hen who's been used in the egg industry, she's very frail, very tiny, because, you know, all she's there to do is produce eggs, and it deprives her body of the calcium in her bones.
Mm. And what about if someone's eating eggs or milk not from a factory farm, but from a small farm? How do you address that? Because I know, you know, lots of people who are vegan and who are animal activists also don't feel like that's really any better. That, you know, they always say there's no real thing as, you know, sustainably raised or, you know, anything better. Is that, do you feel that way?
I do. I mean, it's a couple of things. One is that at the end of the day, these animals are killed at regular slaughterhouses. There's no separate slaughterhouse, so they're still going to be facing the same horrific fate than any other animal being raised. But also, like I stated before, all these dairy farms are still separating the babies from their moms, which is extremely painful for these cows. So they're still separated from their moms, even on these tiny farms. You know, whatever the eggs are coming from for these backyard hens are still coming from an industry which kills the baby male chicks. So, I mean, when we talk about sustainable, the question for me is always, is sustainable for who? You know, is it sustainable to be constantly killing animals? I mean, that's not sustainable for the human beings working in the slaughterhouse, and it's certainly not sustainable for the animals. I mean, our organization works on the lack of access for healthy foods in communities of color and low-income communities, and I acknowledge that it's not easy for everybody to be able to go vegan depending on their financial circumstances, but for the vast majority of people out there, there is the way that we have to lessen some of the suffering that we cause in this world by not causing additional suffering to non-human animals.
Right. Right, right. And, you know, you refer a couple times to financial realities. But, you know, I think eating vegan is not necessarily more expensive if you are willing to do some of the work. That's the key. It's like if you're a mom who's working two jobs, who has no time, obviously it becomes a bigger challenge. But if you are actually buying like dried beans or even canned beans, you can buy cheaply. And, you know, tortillas you can buy pretty inexpensively. And, you know, there are certainly ways of eating vegan that does not have to break the bank.
For some people, that is true. That some of the communities that we do our work in, they don't even have access to fresh produce. And so, and a lot of them don't, you know, they don't have access to much. And a lot of them is just the sheer barrier of transportation. And so most of the people are getting their food from convenience stores and liquor stores, which don't have a lot to offer that's healthy. And so we're trying to work to change that and make sure that what the community wants in the stores is what they're going to get, or if they want to grow their own food, which, of course, we see as an incredible solution to the problem of lack of access to healthy foods.
Uh-huh, right. Let's take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I wanted to talk to you about this campaign that you're running called Shame on Safeway. Maybe you can tell us what that's about. So everyone listening, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Lauren Ornelius about her organization, Food Empowerment Project. Be right back.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm here with my guest, Lauren Ornelius, from the Food Empowerment Project, and she was just about to talk to us about this campaign that they're running called Shame on Safeway. Lauren, you with me?
Yes, I am. Hi, everybody.
Hi. Great. Can you tell us what Shame on Safeway is?
Sure. So, like I stated, we do work on lack of access to healthy foods in communities of color and low-income communities, and we're currently doing our work in a nearby community. It's pretty much in between San Francisco and Sacramento called Vallejo. And when we are doing our work in that community, I should add, we only do work in these communities when asked to. But when we were doing our work, we were making an assessment on the availability of healthy foods. So we actually physically go in and we survey what types of fresh, canned, frozen, and other foods these food establishments offer. But what came out of our work was we found out that a Safeway was located in downtown, but they moved to a suburban location miles away, and they put a restrictive deed on their former property saying that no other grocery store could move into that location for 15 years. Which deprived that community from having a grocery store. So children growing up did not know what it was like to have a grocery store in their neighborhood. And we've since found that this is a common practice that Safeway has been doing around the United States. So we have, I contacted Safeway and discussed with them the problem with this and how it's impacting the health of the community. And they didn't see fit to change this as a corporate policy. So we started a petition which we have on our website, asking Safeway to change this policy because it impacts health of communities. And we also will be doing more actions later this year to really draw the public's eye to what Safeway has been doing and really hold this corporation accountable for impacting community health.
Wow. Well, I'm really glad to know about that because I have a take action portion of my newsletter every week where I ask people to sign petitions and campaigns, and that's really important because we've always heard of food deserts and not having supermarkets in, you know, urban areas, and people in some of the poorest neighborhoods having to, you know, take buses and travel an hour to find an organic tomato or even a fresh tomato. And so when there actually was a supermarket and then they leave, I did not realize that they had the power to keep another market from moving in there.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was astonishing for me, too, to realize that this is a problem that, you know, is a very complicated issue, you know, lack of access to healthy foods. But to find out that a company that is in the business and should be in the business of supplying communities with healthy foods was actually depriving them of one was incredibly shocking to us as well. We found out they did this in Washington, D.C., and they've done this in Colorado. And, you know, it's just despicable that a corporation would put profits so much ahead of even healthy foods for a community that, you know, it's we really feel like, you know, we all need to, again, as you said before, is like stand up and we need to take action and say this is unacceptable.
Right. And you it's totally over profit, you can see, because they know that if another supermarket goes in there, people are not going to take the trek out to the suburbs to their market. Instead, they'll go to the new market that's in town.
Exactly. Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, it's amazing. You know, I always talk about follow the money, you know, when there's always these things going on that we find so despicable or unbelievable, I just say, you know, follow the money.
I know.
You have that in, you know, all kinds of research that's happening, and, you know, it's like what information are we really getting, you know? Well, who's funding the study? Where's the money coming from? And then you find out. I mean, even, you know, go back to politics, but, you know, Trump's ban on Islamic countries, you know, he only picked the countries that he doesn't have business in. You know, the countries like Saudi Arabia, Egypt, you know, that are predominantly Muslim, that have, you know, harbored terrorists from there. Those countries he has business in, so those aren't on the list of ones that we're not allowing in.
Gosh.
You know, yep. you just follow the money. And now when a president has, you know, conflict of interest, it's really so visible. It's just amazing.
Yeah,
but anyway, back to your projects. what can consumers do to help farm workers who pick our fruits and vegetables, other than, you know, joining in on the protests? So is there campaigns that you're doing? Are there ways that my listeners can be of help to your organization?
Sure. Well, we definitely, you know, with the farm worker issue, it's always a little bit tougher. It's not like a lot of the other issues, because what's happening to farm workers is everywhere. And we all need fruits and vegetables to survive. But some of the things we do ask consumers to do is to respect the boycotts called by the farm worker organizations themselves. So the Coalition of Immokalee Workers have a campaign asking people to boycott Wendy's. And so we really encourage people to boycott Wendy's and tell Wendy's why you're boycotting them until they sign the statement with the Immokalee workers that you won't be eating at Wendy's. We also encourage people to support the boycott of Driscoll Berries, which is by the San Quentin farm workers down in Mexico, asking for better wages. So, you know, letting Driscoll's know, Driscoll's tends to make, like, have strawberries and produce like that. So really, you know, not buying Driscoll's berries and telling the grocery stores why you're not buying Driscoll's berries. You can do a Google search, or you can contact Food Empowerment Project for more information. But these are two ways that consumers can really make a difference. Also, you know, buying organic when you can. I know organic can be expensive, but buying organic means one less bad thing to happen to the farm workers. That means that they're not going to be exposed to agricultural chemicals.
Now, what about Driscoll organic? You know, I mean, in my Whole Foods, the organic berries are Driscoll. You know, and
yeah,
I knew about the campaign against Driscoll, but for some reason I thought it had been lifted, but I guess it's not. It's still going on.
Right. Well, there were two separate boycotts. One was called by the Sukuma farm workers, which were up in the Washington area, and that boycott has been stopped. But there's still the San Quentin farm workers down in Mexico who still have a boycott against Driscoll's.
And so that includes the Driscoll organic?
It does.
It does, uh-huh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's good
to
know.
It's all of the Driscoll line. Yeah, and
it's good to know, although I guess we have to really speak out loudly to our local Whole Foods, because that's the only organic berries they have.
Yep, exactly. Whole Foods definitely needs to hear from people who care about, you know, again, we don't see farm workers, you know, that are in the fields, but they are not invisible, and we've got to, they may want them to be invisible, but in our hearts they're not, and we need to take a stand because they aren't able, you know, they got to keep working, and it's our responsibility as consumers who care to use our voices to amplify their campaigns.
Now, with Wendy's, I mean, I tell people to boycott all fast food places. So,
right.
You know, so it's hard to even just pick out Wendy's. I mean, no one should be going to any of those places. But what was it particular about Wendy's that was the issue for them?
So the Immokalee workers have been incredibly successful in getting companies to adhere to paying one more penny per pound for the tomatoes that
tomatoes.
They pick.
Okay,
that's all they're asking for is one more penny per pound, and Wendy's won't agree to it. They have an incredible program to really hold corporations accountable, growers accountable, to make sure that the farm workers are treated with dignity and are paid well, and they're asking Wendy's to sign on to that, and Wendy's for years now have refused.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I remember that from years ago, because, you know, I was when the Immokalee workers were really starting their campaigns and their boycotts, I had that on my newsletter as well, and it kind of, not that it's died off, but it's not as prevalent in, you know, the front page of with everything else going on. But
right.
I do remember Wendy's wasn't participating, and that was already years ago. And, you know, I haven't really stayed up on it, I guess, because I haven't heard about it recently. So it's nice to be, you know, to have it be brought back out to the forefront for me so I can share that with everybody. Now, with the Food Empowerment Project, what are some of your biggest challenges in getting, you know, your work done? What are your biggest challenges?
Our typical challenge is the same as many nonprofits, which is funding. It's hard for people to, you know, the work that we do is really trying to connect all of these various issues of oppression and show that they're all connected, and that by being informed consumers, we can make a difference, and we can have a difference locally and globally by making sure that we eat our ethics and that we really make food choices that represent who we are. So by doing this type of work, we are talking about the suffering of non-human animals, and we're also talking about the suffering of humans as well. And so some people have a hard time making that connection that they're both important. And so we always run this thing of getting supporters who maybe support one aspect of our work but not all of it. And so we don't get the funding like a lot of other organizations do. So we're relatively small still. We're a staff of two, but we have fantastic volunteers all over the country. But I would say that you know, we have a lot of things that we want to do, and the biggest barriers is being able to get them done. But also bureaucracy. Corporations are barriers as well. You know, if we're facing bureaucracy with something we're trying to change for farm workers here in California to help their children with their education. And we face barriers with corporations like Safeway, who will not change a corporate policy to help, you know, healthier lives for communities. We also run barriers with chocolate companies that will not be transparent about where their chocolate's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and it's also hard because as a vegan organization, and you're working with the Immokalee workers and other poor communities, as you said before, I mean, you know, when you're depending on food stamps and food pantries to get a lot of your food, you're not eating healthy, and many of them are really suffering the epidemics of obesity and childhood obesity, childhood diabetes for the kids, and
diabetes. I mean, diabetes is a big one that these communities face because they don't have access to these fresh fruits and vegetables. And so, you know, the work that we're doing, you know, our work in Vallejo, we did a big event there. We released findings of our report. And now we're going to be doing focus groups in May to really distill what it is that the community wants, because too many times well-intentioned NGOs or policymakers tell and dictate to the communities what it is that they want to have in the communities instead of allowing the communities to tell what they want and what their barriers are so that there are solutions that actually work for each community, because every pocket of a community is going to be different.
Right, right. But so often when they have a limited budget, the cheap food, because it's all subsidized in this country, is they can get more bang for their buck, you know, and they don't realize that that bang is killing them, you know?
Right, right.
You know, they just want to put something in their kids' bellies, and they can get more of that something cheaply if they're getting the stuff that's subsidized, which is all the, even the dairy subsidized, the corn, corn's in everything, you know.
Right. Well, a lot of them definitely know, and they don't like it. They just don't have the choice. I mean, many of them, especially the immigrants that we've met in our focus groups, they talk about how they ate healthier in the countries that they lived in before than they do in the United States, because they used to, you know, grow their own food, whereas now they're being forced to buy tomato sauce from the convenience store. So a lot of them are aware of it. They just don't have, you know, one of the barriers for them, other than access, is cost of living, is the cost of the food. And so that's why we strongly support all of the living wage campaigns that go on, because, you know, the more people are going to be paid a living wage, the more the ability to afford some of this healthier food.
Mm-hmm. Now, does your organization get involved in helping start community gardens and backyard gardens that people who are coming from places where they used to grow vegetables can start growing them again?
What we do is we find out what the community wants, and then we support that. And we do know, which, yes, definitely ends up being, I mean, our ideal is everybody growing their own food. I mean, so to be off a system and to be able to provide for their own families. But we know not everybody, such as myself, has ever lived anywhere where you can have a garden. So we really also encourage worker-owned cooperatives, where the money will stay in the community and create skills and jobs for the people in the community. So, you know, we want to find out what the community wants, and then we also want to be talking about these other ideas, which really will help keep the wealth and these programs in their communities.
Uh-huh. And is there, something that you keep hearing over and over again from the communities that you are working with? Is there some universal desire that they're all having?
We haven't started the focus groups. The only universal thing at this point that we've heard is just how much the entire city has no access to healthy foods, no matter where we're at and what we're doing. People are like, I mean, everybody knows it from all walks of life in that community. I would say that the main thing when we did our focus groups in San Jose and Santa Clara was the cost. The cost was actually a bigger barrier than anything else.
The cost of food.
This is why we started our campaign on the living wages, realizing that we need to help communities get paid better wages, because this is, you know, again, we're talking a lot of people of color who work these service jobs, and women and single mothers, and, you know, we really need to do what we can to make sure that we fight for everybody to have a living wage so their family can be healthy and thrive.
Mm-hmm. With the communities that you're working with, when we talk about living wage, are they being paid by the hour, or are they being paid by the day, you know, for the farm work that they're doing?
For the farm
work, by the pound,
it's a separate community. But, yeah, a lot of them are being paid by the count, by how much they're picking, how heavy the bushel is. Some are being paid hourly, but it seems that a lot more are also being paid by how much they're picking, which means, again, you know, if they're sick, or that's when they have to pull their family members in sometime to help out, because they're paid by how much they pick.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's got to be tough.
Yeah. That's why a lot of them are homeless. You know, we're based in Sonoma County, nearby is Napa County. A lot of the wine pickers, a lot of those farm workers are homeless. You know,
uh-huh.
It's despicable.
Now, a lot of the farms actually offer a place to live, don't they? That was my understanding, that for a lot of the farm workers that come in, they're given places to live, and that actually sometimes works against them, because then they're almost like indentured servants.
Right. In California, they have some labor camps, but about 1%, I think it's estimated like 1% of the farm worker populations actually live in these labor camps. And what's frustrating about these camps is two things. Is one is this is, you know, it's great that they're provided some housing. They still have to pay rent. It's not the best housing, some of them. But that is basically the state is paying that, and I don't really care about my tax dollars going to help people, but what's offensive about it is that basically the state is acknowledging that these growers are not paying farm workers living wages, and therefore the state's coming in, where instead the growers should be forced to pay farm workers living wages. The other thing about these labor camps, which is what we're working on right now, is that they require the farm workers to move out of the labor camp when the picking season is over. So if the farm workers, I'm sorry, they force them to move 50 miles away from that labor camp. So if their children are in school, the farm workers have to pull their children out of school during the school session and move 50 miles away, which impacts their education.
Why?
So
can you explain to me the reason for that? I don't understand. Why do they care where they move to?
The department doesn't even remember or have the information about why it was even started, which is something we're continuing to request of them. The only guesstimation that we have is that it's so that other farm workers can live there. But when the picking season is over, the picking season is over and the farms are closed. So we're still at a loss because the department isn't quite sure why this regulation was started to begin with. So I wish I had an answer for it, but we don't. What we're just trying to do right now is push the department to change it so it doesn't so heavily impact the children's education.
Yeah, because, I can imagine them saying, okay, you're not working for me anymore, you need to move out. But why do they care where they go?
I guess it's still hard enough for them
to find another place to live and to pay rent. But
because they want them to still be migrant workers. But it seems that the number 50 miles away is arbitrary.
Huh.
Yeah, it's California is the only state that has that. So there are some labor camps in other states, but none of them have that same regulation.
Uh-huh. And you're basically working out of California mostly, correct?
Our chocolate work takes us international. Some of our other work is national, but our access work is local. But the farm worker stuff we do is United States only because there's farm workers, as you know, in New York and Washington and Oregon. So we try to keep tabs on legislation and other things going on impacting farm workers across the United States.
Mm-hmm. And the issue we were talking about earlier with chocolate, and fair trade and the dark side of chocolate, there's those similar issues around coffee and tea. Do you get involved in those products as well?
We do. We have, not tea, but we do have a list on our website of coffee that we recommend. Since we're so small, the only list that we actively update and work on is the chocolate list. But there are issues surrounding coffee, a lot of problems with fair trade, which people can read about on our website. We also have recommendations for bananas, although there are not many bananas that we recommend, but luckily you are on the East Coast, and for people who can buy equal exchange bananas, those are some we definitely recommend people support.
Where does the equal exchange come from?
They come from Latin America, but they come from smaller farms. So versus some of the bigger farms where they make sure that the workers, and the people who are picking the food and harvesting it are the ones who reap the profits.
Uh-huh. Wow. And you're only two people in your organization. Yeah, that's a lot to try to cover with two, two people.
We have amazing volunteers.
Uh-huh. So how can my community help? What would be the biggest way that I can help you reach out to my community and see how they can help you?
Well, we have on our website a list of top 10 things that people can do to have more ethical food choices. And I think that, having people check out our site, we have an email list that we only email out on once a month. We're also on social media if people want to follow us. Our website is foodispower.org, and that website is in English and in Spanish. We also have a website called veganmexicanfood.com, which is also in English and in Spanish. And that website is full of recipes. So more than anything, people taking a look at their food as a responsibility and making sure that when they buy food, whatever they're putting in their mouth, that they are eating their ethics and just try and become more informed consumers. We have a lot of information on our website that people can check out and get involved in.
Uh-huh. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been very informative. I think the work you're doing is awesome. We need more people doing that work, and I will certainly do what I can to, you know, put your campaigns up in my newsletter, certainly the Shame on Safeway one.
Thank you.
Amazing. And, you know, the Driscoll Berries, I will, you know, try to start some sort of petition or something for people to reach out to Whole Foods, because Whole Foods, you know, certainly is in a position to wield their power a little bit more.
Yep.
They should at least be offering us some organic berries that are not Driscoll. So
definitely. Well, thank you so much for all that you're doing as well, and for being so well-rounded. And you are, you know, that it isn't. It's hard not to talk about politics because it's impacting everything right now. Not
right.
that it hasn't before, but even more so now. It's really wonderful, and, you know, good luck at the demo later today.
Thank you. Thank you. And everyone listening, thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I've been with Lauren O'Neilius from the Food Empowerment Project. Be with you all again next week.